Today's Taisho will be on Case 49 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case 49 is entitled Sancho's The Golden Carp Out of the Net. Ango's Introduction. Seven piercing and eight breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners. 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a great wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a person of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, the golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you have got out of the net, I will tell you. Sancho said, the renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot even find one word to say about this topic. Seppo said, I am the chief abbot and have much to attend to. Secho's verse, the golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say, it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes. A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze comes. Who in this whole universe knows this? Thank you for coming here this morning to practice Zen, Zazen. This is a beautiful day, beautiful summer day. Today when we were doing our kinhin outside, walking, after doing meditation, our minds may have been a little clearer, a little freer of distraction. You know, ordinarily, it's quite common that our minds are so absorbed in their own inner theater that we hardly notice the world around us. If you were coming out of your office or out of your home and you had a million things going on in your mind, you know, you might not notice even the sound of the water or the wind. The warm wind blowing through the leaves. We've done a little meditation and our minds have become quiet, more still and empty. And so when we go outside and walk together, everything around us has a kind of resonance or closeness or presentness that's really delicious, wonderful. As we were walking around those plantings, I kept thinking, this is really, in some ways, the best of human beings, where we've taken our creativity and harmonized it with nature to make this beautiful enclosure. Many, many years ago, some of you remember that there was just a circle of cement there, and very few of those plantings were there. And it was a nice enough spot, but they've really transformed it into a kind of paradise. You know, everywhere the eye turns, you see this rich tapestry of plants, of life. You know, it's exciting, especially if your mind is open and you are surrounded by living things like that. It can be really thrilling. I really do believe that humans have a biophilia tendency, that we have a natural tendency to love life and to want to surround ourselves with other living beings. Some of you might have heard about this idea from E.O. Wilson. He wrote a wonderful book called Biophilia, and he said humans really have an innate, hardwired tendency to take pleasure in being alive and being surrounded by living things. And I really believe it, and I think it's especially true when our minds are open and not preoccupied. I think at those moments of being alive can be felt quite intensely and joyously, and if you're surrounded by things that are alive, it's tremendously exciting. It's like meeting yourself everywhere you turn. And I'm somebody who really loves gardening. I'm married to a fanatic gardener. And I as we were walking around, I couldn't help but notice the beautiful tapestry someone has created. It's just exquisite, and it's exciting, being enclosed by life, and life is taking all of these forms. If your mind is open, if you're relaxed and at ease in the world, it can be really exciting. This koan is about a golden carp, a fish. You know, many years ago, our neighbors, Fidel and Keith, had the idea of creating a fish pond in their backyard, and they wanted Barbara and me to create a pond too. And the idea was that we would have a little stream running from their pond into our pond, and there'd be a hidden pumping mechanism that would take the water back up, and there was a little waterfall. And so, you know, we worked on this for many, many weeks, and we created these two ponds. And we had some fish over the years, some carp and some goldfish in the pond. But I have to say I never paid too much attention to it. Fidel and Keith were really in charge of the whole operation, and they were really enthusiastic about it. And then when they moved away, the people who took their place, John and Patrick, weren't really as interested in fish. But we have a fish, we have a carp, and I have really fallen in love with that fish. It sounds ridiculous to fall in love with a fish, but I'm in love. What can I say? You know, I get up in the morning, and the first thing I think, by the way, Barbara named the fish Phineas. And he is now almost a foot. He's probably a foot long. We've had him since he was really small. And he's a foot long. And I think carp are quite intelligent animals. And I've been researching it online. And people who own carp say that carp are quite intelligent. And in fact, you know, there's been all this new research on fish intelligence. And it turns out some fish are really quite intelligent. They're not stupid brutes. You know, we always think animals are stupid brutes, and then they turn out to be smarter than we thought, or quite stunningly intelligent. And it turns out that fish have incredibly good memories. They said that the memories of some species of fish exceed those of non-human primates. So think about that. You know, fish have very good memories. They have very good, as you might guess, they have very good spatial awareness. And carp are really quite, or koi, as they're called, are really quite intelligent animals. And I've seen this before, you know. There is a place on Route 22 that sells koi. And they have a giant pond, and it's full of koi. And the koi come right up. They're so friendly, and they look you right in the eye. Now, you could say, I'm anthropomorphizing these fish, but I think they're quite intelligent animals. And Phineas is an especially intelligent fish. You know, he's happy to see us. There's no question, you know. We feed him, it's true, so he's happy to get fed. But when we come up to the edge of the pond and he, you know, they can see out through the water, You know, and they see, he sees us. He gets incredibly excited. He swims round, around and around and around very fast. Sometimes he almost jumps out of the water. And when we throw food to him, he sometimes comes up, and he doesn't just eat the food. He's like a trout catching a fly. He'll grab the food and then he'll twist around and swim back down. And when he does, his tail makes a little slap on the water. I think he enjoys it. And so we play this little game where he comes up and he grabs it and he swims down. And sometimes when we come out, even if we're not feeding him, he's very excited and he swims around and around and around in these big circles. And he goes fast. I almost worry about him. He's going so fast. I'm afraid he's going to crash. And, you know, and I have reluctantly, you know, I mean, I haven't really been interested in fish, you know. And yet, you know, I've really fallen in love with Phineas. And, you know, I was reading the other day that carp can live, or koi can live, to be 20 or even 30 years old. So I'm already making plans to expand his pond. You know, as he gets older, he's going to need a bigger pond to retire in. So that's a project for next summer. Maybe we'll expand Phineas's pond. Phineas had a friend who was eaten, unfortunately, by a heron. So we have got to take some steps. We bought a plastic heron, and we move it around the pond. And the idea is that other heron will see it and will think that that's the plastic heron's territory. But we're also going to put a net over the pond while we're gone, just so nothing goes wrong, because I want to come home and try out my French on Phineas. So anyway, you know, I really have come in to love Phineas, and I've discovered that fish are really intelligent animals. And I find watching fish incredibly relaxing. You know, the Chinese, as usual, were far ahead of us on all of this, and they, and the Japanese also, you know, they have developed this whole art of pond culture, aquaculture, with these beautiful, beautiful koi, these beautiful fish, you know, looking at them is incredibly relaxing. They come out of the darkness of the pond, of the pool, and they come up to the light. And you can see their beautiful scales, and it's like something coming from your deep unconscious into consciousness and going back into the unconscious. And this is very, very energizing and liberating to watch, quite relaxing. One last thing. You know, you might not know this, but you know, I'm not the only person who thinks that carp are quite intelligent, koi are quite intelligent. In Chuanzi, there's a famous account where Chuanzi was watching some koi swimming around in a pond, and he said to his friend, he said, "Look at those koi." You know, he said, "They're so happy." And his friend said, "Look, Chuanzi, how do you know they're happy? They're just fish. You're happy." And Chuanzi turned and said, "Well, how do you know I'm happy?" Please think about that for a while. But the point is that maybe all animals feel the same kind of happiness that we feel. At any rate, you know, when you're watching fish play in the water, you can think about them as these carefree creatures who are free to go and come as they please. And it's wonderful if you're having if you've had a stressful day and you have problems to sit down and look at the fish. And you might think, "Oh, those fish, they don't have to worry about budgets and state politics, and they don't have to worry about retirement accounts, and they don't have to worry about people who aren't doing their job," and so on and so on. And, you know, you can look at the fish and think, "Oh, I wish I were free like that fish." So this is an interesting koan in that respect. You know, we all can understand the koan about a golden carp who's gotten out of the net. You know, this is something that's quite elemental, quite primal. You know, the idea of a fish caught in the net is kind of a disturbing image, right? The image of a fish caught in the net. And it's disturbing because we know that we ourselves are often caught in the net. And many people who are asked to work on this koan, of course, immediately understand it on an intuitive level, because they're caught in all kinds of nets. You know, we have so many different kinds of nets. Some nets are obvious. So a friend of mine, he's now retired, became the chair of my department, and he wanted very much to be the assistant dean in charge of personnel. And he had this dream that he could move up through the ladder of academic administration. And so when he became chair of the English department, he wanted to be the best chair that there had ever been. And he wanted to stay on top of all the paperwork and details and really impress the dean's office with his knowledge and his skill and his intelligence. And he had problems. He had certain kinds of problems. He had just gone through his second divorce. And he also had a drinking problem. On occasion, I was his friend, and he would call me up and ask me to drive him home from Charlie Brown's restaurant because he had gotten stopped once by the police and given a breathalyzer test and had some points on his driver's license. And if it happened again, he could lose his license. So sometimes he would drink a little too much, and he would call me up, and I would go and pick him up. And he lived in Highland Park. He lived right down the street from me, so it wasn't really any trouble. He was in some ways trapped, you know. His second marriage had failed, and he was unable to finish his third book. He was working on a third book. And he never did get it finished. Friends of mine read pieces of it and said it was absolutely wonderful. But there was some kind of a block, you know, that prevented him from finishing his book. And he had this drinking problem. Probably it was getting worse because of all these other things going on in his life. He wanted to break out somehow. And his idea, his thought was that he could break out by becoming the best administrator the dean's office had ever seen, and then they would promote him into the job of assistant dean in charge of personnel. And I know he worked tremendously hard on this, you know. And he tried to be this incredibly good department chair in terms of, knowing the rules, being on top of details, impeccable budget. And so he was sort of performing for the dean's office. He wanted them to notice that he was doing this great job. I think you probably know where this story is going, you know. He didn't get noticed. He didn't get become assistant dean of personnel, and eventually, maybe as he was maybe dreaming, even vice president in charge of personnel. He served two terms as department chair, and then he stepped down. And he had an ongoing relationship with a much younger woman. She decided not to marry him and moved to Hawaii. And he took care of his little daughter in Highland Park until he retired. And he lives up in northern New Jersey now. You know, he did other things. You know, he learned, believe it or not, Norwegian. and Swedish, and became one of the best translators of Ibsen in the United States. So, you know, he found some way to use his powers, his abilities, other than being a great administrator at Rutgers. And then, you know, I sort of lost touch with him, you know. But this story, I think, is so human, right? It's so typical. You know, we all get blocked in certain ways. You know, we all get trapped by certain things, you know. People get married and, you know, they want to have a happy life together. And, you know, you generally pick somebody, when you get married, you generally pick somebody who you are simpatico with. You have things in common with. So, you know, you usually don't marry somebody who is you don't like, right? Or who is whom you don't love or whom you have nothing in common with. Usually people make their best choice. You know, and then, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years into the marriage, or 10 years into the marriage, or even 30 years into the marriage, you know, you could find that you're very unhappy, you know. This happens to people. And so now, you know, you've given 10 years of your life to this. You should be happy, but you're not happy, and you think, stay, go. You know, maybe you go, and then you're lonely. You know, so this is like the net, yeah? The net. You do your best to get promoted, and you don't get promoted. You know, you're the best darn English department chair that ever walked down the road, and nobody notices. And when it's done, you get a thank you, or maybe you don't even get a thank you, you know? Maybe people criticize you. That's usually what happens to people who try things, is they get criticized. So, you know, he served, he devoted 2 terms, 6 years of his life to serving the department. You know, I don't think we had a party for him or anything like that. I was a junior faculty member. I was just an assistant professor. Now I would have probably been proactive and said we ought to throw this guy some kind of a party, but we didn't. You know, so you know, he had a dream and it didn't come true, and he probably felt, you know, I'm in my job, but I can't, you know, write this book. I can't finish this book. You know, I've got to do something else. And so you want out, but you're trapped. You want out, but you're trapped. You can't get out. You're in, but you can't get out. And you look at the fish. You know, you think, I'd like to be a fish getting out of the net. I'd like to swim free in the ocean like a fish. You know, if only I could break out of this net. You know, some nets are more subtle than that. You know, those are the obvious nets, right? I mean, you know, if I had asked my friend, what makes you unhappy, I think he would have said, I'm unhappy because I can't finish my book, you know. I just can't finish this project. And that's really difficult. You know, he wrote a very good second book that got a number of awards. His specialty was drama, and he was an incredibly good reader of drama and critic of drama. And he had he had written on tragedy, what makes tragedy. He was really into tragedy. He had given years of his life to the study of, starting with the Greeks, and it used to drive him crazy on the news when they said a tragic death today. He would just, his blood pressure would rise, and he'd want to throw something at the TV. He'd say, that's not tragedy. He had a very specific definition. I guess you had to know him. But it would upset him when people would say something sad was tragic, because he had a whole theory. To be tragic, you have to have a good person who is undermined by forces he can't control. And so when somebody's hit by a car, that's not a tragedy. He'd say, that's sad, and he'd lecture his students on this, and they'd all understand. Mm-hmm. But the point was, he was trapped. And he had these obvious traps, which were, you know, not being able to finish his book, having his marriage go down the tubes, not getting noticed. But, you know, there's other traps too, you know, that are less subtle. Like, why couldn't he finish his book? Right? Very intelligent man, wrote 2 books. One of them had gotten a big prize from the Modern Language Association. Why couldn't he write that other book? You know, people who read pieces of it said, this is fantastic. Really, a friend of mine who's also retired now, read it and he said, Tom's book is going to be amazing. And the book never came out. It never got finished. So, you know, that's a kind of a net that's a deeper net, right? Because we don't know, you know, that's a net we don't fully understand, but it still confines us. You know, there we have lots of nets. Some of them are obvious, you know, like not getting a raise when we deserve it, and some of them are not so obvious because they're unconscious nets, right? I mean, you know, we just can't bring ourselves to do something, and we don't know why. You know, so part of this person wanted to finish the book, but there was another part that couldn't finish the book. And this tore him, maybe this is part of why he drank, you know, because this tore him up inside. You know, things happen to us that we don't even remember or that we don't allow ourselves to remember, and they color our lives very much, you know. Sometimes, they can be profoundly inhibiting. I know somebody who is otherwise like a very mature person, really like a normal, mature, even, you know, very worldly person. And I've seen this person go from like a normal, mature person to like a 12-year-old, you know, in, you know, 3 minutes flat, you know. And then get over it and then be a normal, you know, 50-year-old, 55-year-old person. You say, what was that all about? You know, that person suddenly was 12 years old again, you know, and, you know, almost crying and sort of behaving like a teenager for just a few minutes, and then back to normal, you know. That's like a net, right? Something hasn't been worked out, you know. Somehow there's like, you know, this is in psychological theory, this is called regression. You know, somehow that person is on some level still stuck with some event from when she was, you know, 12 years old, you know, still an angry teenager, you know, in there somewhere. And this is like a net, right, that we don't notice, but it's there. And so, you know, we all want to be free, want to get out of these nets. And so this koan is very powerful because when you sit down, you often become aware of your nets, you know, and that's good, right? I mean, some of the nets are obvious, but sometimes working with a koan like this can help you to understand the nets that aren't so obvious. You know, the nets that are sort of under the surface of consciousness, you know. So, my friend wanted to write his book, but he couldn't write his book. And the more that contradiction ate away at him, the more he drank, you know. So, you know, he didn't do Zen, but I think something like Zen might have helped him, because if he had been working with this koan, you know, if you work with this koan, you start going through all your nets. And you go through this net, and that net, and this net, and that net. And sooner or later, you begin to discover nets you didn't know were there, you know. You begin to discover, oh, you know, I remember this. You know, this I haven't remembered this for 40 years, but, you know, I remember this. And this is part of the process of Zen practice, right? Is working through these nets, these obstacles, you know, that are sometimes obvious and sometimes not so obvious. And, you know, the thing is that there's really no carp, there's no koi who's gotten out of all the nets. You know, that's just a fact. You know, all our life we're going to get trapped again in some net, you know. This is true. You know, so you work through one net only to find you're in another net, you know, a new one. Maybe you created a new one while you were getting out of your last one. An entanglement, or, you know, in traditional Buddhism, people talk about karma. And you could think about karma as your psychological habits, you know. So if you are having trouble writing your book and you're blocked, you know, you want to write the book, but you can't write the book, that's there's something karmic about that. In other words, something is under the surface there. There's something behind that contradiction, right? You know, maybe you're afraid of not measuring up to your own high ideals, and so every word you write is going to be less than it should be, right? You know, you don't write because you're afraid that if you put something down, you'll see it's mediocre, and that means you're a mediocre person. You know, that is quite common. You know, every word has to be great. Well, if you're expecting every word to be great, you're not going to be able to write anything, because most of what everybody writes is pretty mediocre. You might have a hard time dealing with the mediocrity of what you write, because, you know, basically that means you're a mediocre person. But then, you know, what's wrong with being a mediocre person? You know, it's okay to be just another guy on the street, you know, just another... There's 8 billion human beings, you know, most of them are mediocre. You know, and I actually like the, you know, that's mediocre's okay, right? You know, so you know, maybe there's something there, right? Where, you know, you don't like yourself, you know, you don't like yourself, and so you know, you're afraid that if you write something, it's going to show your worst fear about yourself, which is that you're ordinary, pedestrian, uninspired, etc., etc. And that seems like a fate worse than death, unless you sit with it a while, and then you think, you know, it's okay to be, you know, I mean, we have this word in English, a loser, you know. You know, that's a fact. You know, I was reading something the other day where a guy was actually, he's a wonderful literary critic, and he has an article called Reading Like a Loser. And it's brilliant, and I loved it when I read it. It was so liberating, because he said, you know, all of these people say we should read, we should be strong readers, we should be creative readers. And he said, and he was looking at Nietzsche, the philosopher Nietzsche, and Nietzsche says, you know, you have to be strong, you have to be creative, you have to be artistic. And the guy said, you know, no you don't. He said, really, this is a trap. He said, you know, it's okay to read like a loser, you know. He said, reading like a loser... You know, you don't have to be the Ubermensch. You don't have to be a Superman. You don't have to be a genius. Who says, you know? He said, it's okay to be just an ordinary person. This is very, by the way, very Taoist, very Zen, right? It's okay to, you know, it's okay to just be a person in the marketplace. Just be an ordinary human. I'm comfortable, you know, if you can be comfortable with that, you know, life can be very good. If not, life is going to be one perpetual hellish struggle, right? You know, most of the books in the library are not read. Have you noticed that? You know, I'll go in and check out a book, and I'll notice it hasn't been, you know, if you go to libraries where they still stamp the books, it's like last checked out 10 years ago. You know, and this person published at a top press, you know, very distinguished person, no, just sitting in the library. So, you know, this is the fate of most ideas, you know. But my friend, for all kinds of reasons, couldn't go down this road, you know. So he had made writing into this terrifying experience where he put himself on the line. He had to be Ibsen or nothing, right? It's like that made it impossible for him to write. So that's sort of karma. And you know, then he started drinking, and that's creating more karma, you know. So you know, we're constantly sort of entangling ourselves in these nets, and in a certain way. You know, Zen practice goes on forever. You know, you might have heard there's an article by Sigmund Freud that says analysis terminable and interminable. And it's like you could go to your therapist forever, right? Because you're always, you know, there's always some new tangle, you know. And Freud says, you know, this is a fact, you know, you're sort of like it never ends in a way. Well, Zen practice is like that too. You know, you work through your koan, you go out in the street, and then something happens, and now you have a new phobia, or you have a new anxiety, right? And you're back on the cushion. You could say, well, what a fraud Zen is, you know? But that's life, right? That's life. That's life. You create, you know, how, you know, you see, the thing is, I think that the original Buddhists didn't 100% understand the Buddha, because they thought you could really get out of the net. See, I think they did. I think they thought you could really get out of the net once and for all, you know. And so they, you know, early Buddhists, I think, wanted to get out of the net. They thought, I'm out of the net once and for all, see. And you know, this concept of the arhat is, you know, the arhat is an enlightened being who is, and by the way, arhats are not supposed to mingle with other people. They're supposed to live by themselves. They're you know, they generally live in a monastic milieu. And in folk Buddhism, they're, after enlightenment, they're not supposed to live very long. And this is not the Buddhist teaching, by the way, but it's sort of folk Buddhism in Southeast Asia. And the idea is that once you're enlightened, this world is, you're finished with this world, and you really don't belong here anymore. That's not the Buddhist teaching, but I think it's how early Buddhists understood the path. You know, I'm going to get out of the net once and for all, and that will be great. And then the prospect of constantly getting entangled in the net, where you swim out, you get out of the net, but then you get back in it, and now you're in another net, this seems depressing from a certain standpoint, right? But on the other hand, there's the Mahayana view. See, if you ever have the time to read 2,000 pages, if you're just sitting around and you'd like to, and War and Peace was too short for you, yes, and you have a long stretch of time in which you have no demands on your energies, and you want to be deeply inspired, I highly recommend, and I have not finished it, I highly recommend the Flower Ornament Sutra, because it's this gigantic book. And it's magnificent. And actually, the book, reading the book is meditation. This book was written to be, the reading process becomes a kind of meditation. And everything takes forever to happen. You know, so basically, they describe the Buddha, and they describe his clothes, and they describe the magnificent retinue of bodhisattvas around him. And then they describe the heavenly gods, the devas, above him, and their clothes, and their retinue. And there's behind them, there's another group, you know. And so as you're reading this, what's happening is it's like you're starting with a focal point, you know, the Buddha. And then it's opening up, it's opening up, it's opening up, it's opening up, it's opening up. And you keep going through this process of going beyond the boundaries of your initial starting place, and going in circles, getting bigger, 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 bigger. And this goes on again and again throughout the book. So the book is really a kind of meditation practice. And a very famous Buddhist scholar said, you know, when I sit down and read the Flower Ornament Sutra, he said, my head feels full of light. You know, just following this meditation practice. So it's quite beautiful. But the key metaphor in the Hua Yan, the Flower Ornament Sutra, this is Kegon Sutra, the key ornament, illustration or symbol is the net. See? But now the net is like this wonderful thing. See, because the Flower Ornament Sutra says, hey, the universe is Indra's net. See? And it's nobody created it, and it has no beginning and it has no end. Indra's net. And it's a svayambhu, it's self-creating. And basically, the net is everywhere, and at each point of intersection in the net, there's like a little drop of dew, like a little pearly drop of dew. And in that pearl, all the other parts of the net and all the other pearly drops are reflected. See? So the net becomes this glorious thing, right? This glorious place to be. And at every point of intersection, there's this luminous drop. And it goes on and on in all directions. And so it's like reflections in reflections in reflections on out to infinity. This luminous net. And the method of Huayan, of Kegon Buddhism, is constantly to focus on something, and then their meditation practice is to start with an object and then move outward from the object. And you begin to see how everything is interconnected with everything else. See? Everything brings you to everything else. Nothing can exist without all the other things around it. So the key idea for Huayan Buddhism, or Kegon, is the co-arising of all things, the dependent co-arising. Everything is arising together with everything else. This is the highest statement, I think, of the Mahayana. So basically, one way to look at the net is that it's this terrible, terrible thing, right, that gets us trapped. But another way to look at the net is that this is Indra's net. You know, this is precious opportunity to be alive, which is in itself quite extraordinary, and then to experience, first of all, our limitedness, right, and then our connectedness, and then our infiniteness. And these things go together, you know. If you have had a terrible day, you've had a really bad day, and you feel your limitedness, right? You know, something happens and it knocks you right on your ass, and it hurts. It hurts, you know. To be blocked, it hurts. And you sit down on the cushion, and you sit, you know, with that pain, and, you know, sooner or later you could have this feeling, like, it's just like the doors open up. And you feel like, you know, I feel so much better, I feel so, you know, I'm alive. This is like the adventure of being alive, you know. When we're, that feeling of being trapped, when that goes away, and we feel connected with the world around us, then there's this release of energy and there's joy, you know. So usually there's this feeling of confinement or being trapped, and then, you know, there's a long period of working through that, and then there's an opening, and then there's this feeling of, like, expansiveness. This happens to people who meditate all the time, or it should be happening once in a while. And this is a process people go through, where you're trapped, you hate it, you hate it, you hate it, then there's some kind of opening, and then there, you just feel this adventure of being alive. You know, art does this too, right? You know, art does this too. If you ever see a play like Hamlet, you know, half the people in Hamlet wind up dead at the end, you know? And if you watch the play, it's tremendously exciting, and actually, you know, you can even feel good after it's all over. And you think, how is that possible, right? I mean, all these people have suffered, all these people have... Part of it is we know it's a play, we know it's not real. But, you know, the message of the play is that life is a big adventure. You know, life is an adventure. So, you know, hopefully you don't get stabbed by somebody, but you go out onto the street and you might feel like, you know... This is like a big play, and I'm a character in the play, and it's good to be alive. It's interesting, you know. I'm happy to be in this drama. Now, we don't always say that. Sometimes we're really unhappy to be in the drama, and we want the drama to be over. But that's not necessarily a life-affirming attitude. So the Mahayana says that all life is sacred. And that even things that cause us a lot of pain give us the opportunity to experience that constraint, opening, and then infiniteness, right? The interconnectedness of things. And so, you know, there's two aspects to the net, and both of them are real. Both of them are real. You know, the mind says it's either or, but actually, you know, there's two aspects to the net. one aspect really is the painful experience of confinement, which is very difficult and nobody likes. And there are days when all people say, I wish I were out of this net. You know, let me out of this net. Let me swim free like Phineas. You know? But then, if you try to avoid that experience, you don't become a big person, I think. Right? I mean, basically, if you try to avoid that experience, you can't do anything. You know? I mean, I'm not criticizing my wife, whom I love, but she hates mathematics, you know? She just hates it. And I was very good in math, because when we were both 12 years old, or 14, we were both like the class dunces in the math classes. You know, she lived in Albuquerque and I was in Southern Virginia. And I didn't know her yet. But we were both like at the bottom of our class in Algebra 1. Math was so painful for me and difficult. But I had a teacher who wouldn't let me quit. And I said, just fail me out and I'll go into the... There was a course called Shop Math, which was just mathematics for people who were going to need to calculate things if they were going to be carpenters and things. And I said, just put me in the shop math class, you know, and I'll never have to learn, because I can't figure out these X's and these Y's. 2X plus 2Y, you know. I can't do it. I can't. And I couldn't figure it out. My parents, they couldn't help me at all. They were terrible in math, too. My father would light a cigarette, he'd sit down, and he'd say, okay, 2X plus 2Y, and he couldn't work it through, you know, and he'd get angry, and then I would feel frightened, and I, you know. So, but my teacher wouldn't let me quit, and it was very, very painful, you know, very painful to hang in there and keep failing at math. But then after the middle of the semester, I actually figured out how to do algebra. I actually figured it out. And I got straight A's the second half of the semester. My wife just didn't do that, you know? She didn't have a teacher who helped her. She got put into the class with the people who weren't going to ever finish algebra. And she hates math. Like, even now, math, like, terrifies her, right? She can add and subtract. I meant algebra terrifies her. There are things that still terrify me that she's very good in, so it evens out. But the point is, you know, learning algebra was very painful for me and difficult. But I'm so glad I got through it. I'm glad I figured out algebra, you know? So if you try to avoid that pain, you never learn algebra. I myself have avoided all kinds of pains in life, and so haven't developed fully as a human being. Most things that make us bigger people require us to sit in the net and be trapped for a while. And that's a difficult lesson, yeah? But if we don't do that, we don't grow, I think. Same thing with, a piano. I have a friend who's an incredibly good musician. And her mother used to make her practice every day, and she hated it. She hated it. And she said, now I just can't thank my mother enough. Her mother's dead, but she said, can't thank my mother enough. I love to play the piano. I hate it every day. Was trapped in that net. Have you done your piano? No. You're doing it. No. Yes, you're doing it. You know, this finally, you know, 30 years later, this is my greatest joy, playing a piano, you know. So being stuck sometimes is what is required to be free, yeah? And if we try not to be stuck, then if we try to avoid being stuck, we don't become sometimes the biggest people we can be. And in Zen practice, you know, sometimes working with koans means encountering our nets, you know, and going back to being stuck, right? Sometimes we dodge being stuck, you know. We dodge it. We avoid the things that cause us to feel stuck. And sometimes in Zen practice, as in life, you have to go back and you have to go to that place that you didn't want to be stuck in. And you can cry and you can be upset, you know, and it can be very difficult. But it's like you have to work it through, you know, sometimes it's like that. And that never stops, you know. My teacher, Genki Roshi, was a deeply enlightened person, but sometimes he could be a 12-year-old, you know. He still had things he had things he still needed to work through. I have things that I still need to work through. There are some being, I have not wanted to be trapped in certain ways, and so I am still 12 years old in some ways. And that's true for Genki too. And so, you know, at 56, I have to go back and be 12 and pick up where I was when I was 12 to work through some of these obstacles. And we all have to do that sometime. Oh, yes, and please don't tell my wife I said she wasn't good in math. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, "The golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on?" Seppo said, "When you have gotten out of the net, I will tell you." See? There's no getting out of the net. The net is the universe. Sancho said, "The renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot find even one word to say about this topic." He says, "So you say you're supposed to be a great Zen master?" And Seppo says, "Come on, give me a break. I have a lot on my plate." Secho's verse, "The golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fin, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes." A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze. Who in the whole universe knows this?